Sammy and Susie are being a little bit anxious today. We've been gone for a couple days and somebody is missing us a little bit, aren't you?
I was missing you a little bit.
Oh, yes, you too.
Oh.
So, yeah, that's probably why if you hear growling going on, it's Susie being like, Mommy, pet me. Or let me lick your face, because I love it so much. I am a dog.
Now, you're not about to tell me about a turkey killer, are you? Because I can't do any more
turkey. No, I mean, I didn't intend for this to be like Thanksgiving related, but it kind of is.
No, I am not a tryptophan.
A tryptophan?
Of this. I can't do any more turkey.
All right, well, there's no turkeys involved.
All right, can't wait to see how it relates to Thanksgiving.
Okay. Here we go. Are you ready? Put your seatbelt on.
We're in bed.
Just kidding. Put your imaginary seatbelt on then. Okay.
Your metaphorical seatbelt on.
Sure, that one.
It's the law.
All right, well, this is Killer Pillow Talk, Episode 9. And I already came up with a title for it because I'm great with that.
Oh, let's hear it.
Only Murders in the Boarding House.
I'll be the judge of that.
Well, it works.
But who publishes? Yeah, and you're playing very well off of the show Only Murders in the Building.
Which I love, and I should be in the second season because I'm perfect for it. Because I host my own true crime comedy podcast. Hello.
Just like they do.
Hint, hint, hint. Okay.
Hulu, can you sponsor us?
Yeah, Hulu, sponsor us. Or if you want to turn our show into a TV series, feel free. I'll definitely star in it. Okay. All right. So this is the story of Dorothea Puente, a.k.a. the Black Widow of Sacramento. Not San Sacramento. That's not a place. The grandma serial killer, or known as the Death House Landlady. She had a lot of nicknames.
I'm just trying to think. I think one of the genres of music that I like is Death House, isn't it?
Death House Landladies?
Landlady is the band, and Death House is the type of music.
You don't seem like the type of person would listen to that. You don't listen to Death House, anything. You're trying to make yourself seem edgy.
I'm trying to make myself seem edgy, yes. Is it working?
No, really. I think Charlie's referring to this because I used to have a lot of ex-boyfriends that had tattoos and mm-hmm. were like in like rock and roll
mm-hmm.
bands.
Mm-hmm. I'm still deciding where I want a tattoo to go.
He's like, but where is it going to hurt the least?
Under my foot. No, that's like where it would be out of the way. where would it be most least painful?
I think the foot is actually
elbow
very painful.
Skin.
I have. Tattoo on my foot.
Does it hurt the back of the knee?
Anywhere that there's a bone, then yes.
There's no name for the back of the knee.
The back of your knees. Okay, so let's get into it. On November 7th, 1988, Officer Rick Ewing comes into the office of Detective John Cabrera with a report saying that a social worker, Judy Moyes, wanted to file a missing person for one of her clients. The client's name was Alberto Burt Montoya. And
my name is Alberto Burt Montoya. You killed my father. Prepare to die.
Not quite, but what? Very sure. Well, he wasn't a swordsman. He was a
Princess's bride.
No. Oh. He was originally from Costa Rica. He was a man in his mid-50s, and he had a mental disability of some kind. So he had, like, he was, like, 50-something, but he had,
I feel bad making fun of him.
I didn't want to say anything right away, but I was like, oh, this is not going well. But, yeah, I think it's said that he had, like, the more, like, the mentality of, like, a 10-year-old or something.
Okay, so we're back to the Princess Bride.
So,
he
was homeless, and he would often wander the streets, and that's how Judy met him. She encountered him, like, kind of wandering around, and she's a social worker, and she was like, oh, I want to help this man.
Yeah. A man. So, at the time, it was a man.
So she sought to help him out, and she found him a place to live in downtown Sacramento at a boarding house at 1426 F Street.
F for fucked.
a little bit. The residence was owned by 59-year-old Dorothea Puente.
Isn't it Dorothy?
No, it's Dorothea.
How's it Dorothea?
Because it's spelled D-O-R-O-T-H-E-A.
Could you imagine if they were like, Dorothea! Dorothea! In The Wizard of Oz? It would have been terrible.
Well, that's not... That's why her name is Dorothy and not Dorothea in The Wizard of Oz. Hmm. Anyway. She was a seemingly kind, caring old woman who opened her home to wayward, homeless seniors.
Like you do. I've met a few of them.
Wayward, homeless but seniors?
Waywardly kind. What were you talking about? The kind old women.
Seemingly caring old women who right. open their homes to wayward, homeless seniors.
Right.
That's hard to say fast. Anyway. She was very highly regarded in the community and was even compared on some occasions to Mother Teresa.
Mother Dorothea.
But not by me. Other people. This is just from, like, I got most of my information from a documentary on oxygen.
Yeah. I didn't think there was much to say about oxygen, but if you can make a whole documentary about oxygen...
No,
Oxygen is the network.
You know, the network about, right. that used to be like television for women, like Lifetime, but now it's just straight crime stuff, because they're like, this is what women like.
Want to breathe in this.
Let's just go straight true crime. Get rid of all the rom-coms and, you know, made-for-TV, like, inspirational movies, and just put all the true crime stuff on there.
Right.
Yes, Susan. So, Dorothea agrees to take Bert in as a tenant, and she helps him out by getting him on disability, and things are starting to look up for good old Bertie boy. Yay!
So you're already giving him a nickname.
I want to.
Alright.
And Judy's like, don't get too attached, great.
Is what I've learned.
Judy's like, great, Bert's doing better, everything is going well. And then she has a conversation with him at one point where he says, like, I don't really think I want to live here anymore. And then she's like, well, just, like, sleep on it or whatever and think about it. Let's not make any rash decisions.
In this case, make a rash decision.
I know. And then she, after, like, a couple of weeks, she hasn't heard from him. She tries calling Dorothea and she's like, he's not here.
All right, someone made a rash decision. It's the wrong person.
Or, like, he's not available to talk to right now. I sent him to Mexico to, like, stay with my brother or something like that.
Look at what you did.
And Judy was like, no, don't send him to Mexico to stay with your brother. That's a terrible idea. So I don't know if he actually ever went to Mexico or if that was just Dorothea saying that he went to Mexico. But
he'll get a tan, but
she's worried about him, so...
Not a good idea.
So Judy's really worried about him, and she calls finally, like the last time she calls, she's like, I'm going to call the police if you don't tell me where he is. If he doesn't turn up by like Monday morning, I'm going to call the police and, you know, have them come over and question
him. Now, we've been in Sacramento before. When is this in Sacramento?
This is the 80s.
So after we were there.
After we were there last time.
Episode.
Sorry, Sacramento. You're like the murder capital of everywhere.
Sorry, Sacramento.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know why people from Sacramento just are like...
I'm sure you're lovely now.
This is where you go to become a serial killer. Sacramento, California.
Training wheel.
Anyway. Yeah. Especially in the 70s, too. It was like a big time then. Like in the 70s, it was like serial killer renaissance. Anyway.
All right, so just like with Ernie on Sesame Street, Bert's unreachable.
Okay, so yeah, she can't get a hold of him. And and then out of the blue, she gets a strange call from, like, a man. He doesn't really say who the man is that he's calling, saying that Alberto's nephew picked him up from the boarding house the day before and moved him out.
His name is Alberto.
Alberto, okay. Bert, you know. So, yeah, they said that his nephew came and picked him up, and they moved out of the boarding house together. And Judy's like, well...
He doesn't have a nephew.
I don't even know if he has a nephew or any family. I mean, obviously, because he was a vagrant that was wandering around on the streets when she found him. He probably would have said something if he... Or maybe he wouldn't have any.
Stan? He's 5. What do you mean he picked him up?
So, Yeah, she was like, this is kind of a little bit sus.
This is sus.
So she calls in the boys in blue. The cops, that is, not the Blue Man Group.
The S... what's the Sacramento Police Department? The SPD.
Yeah.
SCPD?
I don't know.
But the lovely people over at Sacramento.
Sacramento Police Department. So yeah, so Officer Ewing is put on the case. And he goes and he visits Dorothea's boarding house and he questions the residents and they all give him the same story that Bert was living here, but his nephew came by on Sunday and packed up his stuff and they haven't seen him since. And that was the Sunday before the day before Judy was gonna call the police on Dorothea. Bert's 50 something.
So it would make sense if he has a nephew.
It could, but I mean, like, I don't think Judy had very much of a history of
the family.
His family, so, right. Like, it is very strange that out of nowhere this nephew comes out of the woodwork and is, like, here.
It is suspicious. We use sus, and now we use suspicious.
So, they all the residents say the same thing, and so Officer Ewing's like, all right, well, I guess everything's fine, so he goes to leave, but then, like, one of the tenants, his name is John Sharp, he passes Officer Ewing a note, and the note says, she's making me lie.
Sharper's attack, that John Sharp.
So, on November 11th, 1988, John Cabrera and Officer Ewing visit 1426 F Street.
I thought you were going to say, like, passed him a note, and you don't do that thing where you flip it back and forth in your hands.
That would be too complicated. I don't think we have time to make origami. That thing
they pass around in school, that dream cat, what's that thing?
Wish cat. The big mouth.
Yeah, the big mouth. Red, blue, yellow, she's making me lie. Okay.
That seems like it would take too long. I think this is kind of like
I was having fun flipping it around in my
mind. I know. I don't think they would. He'd be like, why are you giving me this, man?
What an 80s thing to do. 90s.
That was a 90s thing. I was a kid in that time.
All right.
So.
The police show up.
Yeah. So this time, Officer Ewing comes again with John Cabrera, which is the detective. And they question Dorothea. And she's like, I don't know where Bert is. I haven't seen him since he packed up with his nephew and left.
Odd. She did say the nephew. I thought she wasn't going to mention the nephew. They all rehearsed this nephew
story. Yeah, so then she gives them permission to search the property. And she's like, okay, yeah, sure, whatever, search everything. And they don't...
Okay, sure, whatever, search everything.
They don't... I don't know if she said it like that, but...
That's what she said. That's a quote. You wrote that down.
I didn't quote that. She said, okay, sure, whatever. They don't find anything pertaining to Bert in particular in the house.
What about the nephew?
Or the nephew.
Oh.
But when Detective Cabrera interviewed Judy initially about the case, because Judy Moyes is the one that filed the complaint and, you know, the missing persons report, she said that they should bring shovels with them because when she visited the residence in the past, she noticed fresh mounds of dirt, like... piles of dirt just kind of like lying around in the backyard.
Now, didn't the Moyes woman say something about a shovel?
Something like that, yeah.
That's what I imagine.
So they like, after they search her her residence, they're like, well, before we leave, we'd like to
do some digging
in your yard. And she lets them do it. She's like, sure, dig in my yard.
They find a skeleton. We had a large dog die.
So they start digging and to pick a spot in the yard, just anywhere, and not expecting to find anything until they hit something very hard.
And that's Fido. He was a good boy.
Well, John Cabrera apparently thought it was a tree root at first, so he kept like trying to break it with a shovel.
I'm clanging on a metal tree root.
And they were also getting these little pieces of like what they thought were fabric and like kind of clothes and like
up the tree roots wearing the jean.
And then when they pull up, they pull on it more, they realize, oh, that's not a tree root, it's a human femur bone. Dun dun dun.
No, it's dun dun.
Okay, that's Law and Order.
Yeah, but the cops are here.
Not doing Law and Order.
We were doing cops interviewing people. Right, that's Law and Order.
Okay, fine.
Fine, we'll go dramatic. Dun, dun, dun.
Okay.
Ooh, a femur bone?
I think it's a femur bone.
And the femur does shatter pretty good.
It's whatever the one where
in your leg.
In your leg, yeah. The one where front your shin is.
Yeah,
that one. Anyway.
Oh.
So, Dorothea has been keeping some secrets, obviously.
She's been keeping some femurs.
So, let's go back and find out who Dorothea Puente really is.
Wait, we're doing a time jump?
We're doing a time jump. We're going back.
Are we Benjamin Buttoning this?
Bring it back. I'll bring it back.
As everybody was getting older, I was getting young.
Sure. We're Benjamin Buttoning. Okay. So, born Dorothea Helen Gray in West Redlands, California, on January 9th, 1929.
Oh, 20 days before my birthday.
That's what Susan has to say about.
Susan, you love my birthday.
At the beginning of the Great Depression.
When was she born? 29?
1929,
January 29. 9th. Yeah. Wait, January 9th, 29.
Yes.
Wow.
She was born to Trudy Mae Yates and Jesse James Gray.
Ah, Trudy Mae. Oh, Jesse James, one of the most crazy, one of the most wanted guys for robbing trains and stuff.
Well, I'm pretty sure this is not the same guy because it's the
1920s. All right. If you say so, you're the detective.
Anyway, so she had a very traumatic childhood because her parents were both alcoholics. And according to the Oxygen documentary that I watched, her mother was actually a sex worker and was, like, never home at all. So I guess the father was kind of, like, presumably there to take care of the kids.
But drunk.
He was also very depressed. He had tuberculosis. So he often, like, would try and kill him. He, like, numerous occasions he would try and kill himself in front of the children.
He had prolonged TB.
Yeah.
TB with complications.
Yeah, he repeatedly threatened to kill himself in front of his family. Like, he tried to hang himself once, I think.
No, I don't like that. We can shut this off.
But in 1937, the tuberculosis finally got him.
So he was saying he was going to do it the whole time, but it was the TB.
It was the TB in the end, yeah. And then a year later in 1938, the mother lost custody of both of her children. And
Dorothea has a brother?
Yeah, she has, I think...
Sister?
I think she has, like, it says that, I think she had actually more than one. I wrote both, but I think that's because they only show, like, her brother in the documentary, so I assume she only had two, but I think she has, like, five kids. But, yeah.
Four other siblings?
Yes, she has four other siblings.
Mm. Big family.
I'm pretty sure. So, yeah, she lost custody of the children, and then she died in a motorcycle crash.
The mother?
Yeah. Ugh. By the end of the year.
What motorcycle was she on?
I don't know. So Dorothea and all of her siblings were then sent to an orphanage, and Dorothea, while she was there, was sexually abused.
Wait, what motorcycle was she
on? I don't know. She was a sex worker. She had a wild time. She went out with men on motorcycles, and she crashed.
In the 30s?
I don't know. Possibly.
Height of the Depression?
She was doing a wild time, you know, living her life.
The fullest. Barely had cars back then.
So Dorothea learned from a very...
Oh, wait. Dorothea was sexually assaulted in the...
In the orphanage that she moved into.
Isn't turning out well.
I know.
I know how it ends. This isn't turning out well.
So she learned from a very young age that the only person you can rely on is yourself. And...
If you want a problem done right, go on.
And she became a survivor by exploiting and manipulating other people. In 1945, when she was 16 years old, Dorothea married World War II soldier Fred McFall.
Oh.
Dorothea gave Fred two daughters between 1946 and 1948. One daughter she sent to live with relatives in Sacramento, and the other she put up for adoption. So they didn't keep the kids. And then in 1948, she had a miscarriage, and because of that. Well, maybe not just because of that. There might have been other reasons, but Fred ended up leaving her as a result.
Nick Fall.
Yeah, I think he might have left her because of the miscarriage, and also because maybe she was like she has been known to like have to lie a lot.
She's a liar?
A little bit.
You set that up in the beginning.
She's a pathological liar.
She's making us lie. Remember that? It was like 5 minutes
ago. Yeah. So that spring after Fred leaves her, she gets arrested.
Wait, the spring after the McFall?
The spring after
the McFall. The McSpring after the McFall? The
McSpring after the McFall.
Okay, go on. Let's make sure I get my timeline right.
She was arrested for purchasing accessories, I guess purses and handbags and socks.
Yeah, you can do that on 24th Street.
With bad checks, quote unquote, bad checks.
Yeah, you can do
checks.
That in 24th.
Not the good checks, the bad checks. In Riverside. And she was charged with 2 counts of forgery and was sentenced to 4 months in jail and 3 years probation.
Bad checks in Riverside, isn't that like a Paul Simon song?
No, it might be a Neil Simon play.
It might be
though.
A Neil Simon play.
6 months later, she Look decides, okay, I'm done with Riverside. Riverside and me aren't getting along, so she leaves.
Riverside and Me is a Paul Simon song.
Sure. In 1952, then, at the age of 23, she marries her second husband, a merchant seaman named Axel Brand Johansson in San Francisco.
He's German.
Swedish, I think.
Swedish.
Maybe he's German. I don't know. He's Scandinavian in some way.
I would have been gone by Axel Brand.
It's Brand, like, you know, like Brand, like the cereal.
The Flakes, yeah. Axel Brand was one of my early stage names. I had many.
Anyway, speaking of stage names, she created a fake persona and called herself...
pseudonym.
Taya Singoala.
What?
I'm going to repeat this. Singoala.
Taya Singoala. You're right, it's hard to say.
Yeah.
So, Taya... wait, no, hold on. Taya, T-E-Y-A.
Yeah.
Singoala. Sing, like the word sing.
Oala.
A-L-L-A. N-E-Y-O.
No, it's an A. Two A's.
A. Two A's?
Mm-hmm.
N-E-Y-A-A-R-D... A?
Yep.
That's just the alphabet. That's just the whole alphabet.
I don't know. She made up this name, and she also claimed to be a Muslim of Egyptian descent, which she was obviously
She was lying about that?
She's white.
The name makes a little bit more sense when she's trying to say she's a Muslim of Egyptian descent. But
well, she did have dark hair when she was younger, but she was definitely
She's
not.
Very white in this case?
She's white.
Okay.
Very much a white person.
All right, well then, yeah, it's
so
a little
it's
weird.
So it's very problematic. It's so problematic. At least I was like, okay.
It is problematic.
But, so yeah, her marriage to Axel was...
Also, that name does not fit on any form.
I know. So her marriage to Axel doesn't really, like, go very well either. It's not all sunshine and roses.
Well, I was at the Axel Taya wedding. It was, a small affair.
So he would go out on these like sea voyages because he was like a seaman, as
open,
I said.
Open bar.
And then when he was out on these voyages, she would invite men over to their house and like gamble away all of his money.
Well, I like that.
So I think at one point she was even like actually running like a brothel out of their house. And
this is where she practices running. Yeah. Terrible places for kids to live.
And in 1960, she gets arrested again for owning and operating a brothel and posing as a...
No, I just got my business started.
Owning and operating a brothel that was posing as a bookkeeping firm in Sacramento. So
that doesn't make any sense.
I don't know. I don't know why she was like advertising it as a bookkeeping firm. But it was, like, secretly a brothel. He's like, get your books kept. And also get your books kept. And also your...
Books kept.
Undercarriage.
If you know what I mean.
Or whatever. I don't know.
Keep your books and I'll book your keep, if you know what I mean.
Okay. So, yeah, how she got caught was actually an undercover cop, like, came into the brothel, mm-hmm. and she came on to him and offered him oral sex, so uh-huh. he arrested her.
And then nothing happened, so she's arrested and kept in jail.
She was found guilty and spent 90 days in jail.
90 days?
90
Three
days.
Measly months.
Yeah. And I don't even know if she even, like, actually stayed that entire time.
Left after 17 days on good behavior.
Or something like that. But in 1961, her husband, Axel, has her committed to the DeWitt State Hospital for...
DeWitt?
DeWitt. Yes.
Like, that's like you.
Like Hewitt with a D. And he had her committed for binge drinking, lying, criminal behavior, and suicide attempts. So...
Night. And she stays in jail.
No. She's in the hospital, she's not in jail.
And she stays in the hospital.
Well, so while she's in the hospital, the doctors diagnose her as a pathological liar with an unstable personality.
And she's committed to an institution.
I don't think you can... not really. So in 1966, Dorothea and Axel get a divorce. And Dorothea now assumes the identity of Sharon Johansson. And at this point, she's kind of, like, not as young and attractive as she used to be, so she can't really, like, rely on her looks as much to get men to do things for her. So she portrays herself as this, like, kind Christian woman in order to, like, hide all of her delinquent behavior that she's doing on the side. But she did find a new way to support herself by working as a nurse's aide and caring for elderly and disabled people in their private homes. Because, like, I guess, like, if you're a nurse's aide, sometimes, like, you don't have to have, like, credentials or whatever.
And it's so sad because the people have no idea that she's this crazy woman.
Yeah, and she seems, she has, like, her demeanor seems, like, very much, like, sweet old lady.
They see a sweet old nurse's age.
Yeah. So, in 1968, she marries her third husband, Roberto Jose Puente, in Mexico City.
So there's that Mexico again.
Yeah. He's 19 years younger than her. The marriage didn't last very long. It was, like, 16 months... after 16 months, they separated, and Dorothea cited it was because...
irreconcilable differences.
No, domestic abuse.
Oh, domestic... domestic abuse, yeah.
Yeah, which is a good reason to get divorced. I would not
domestic
wanna,
abuse, yeah.
I not want to do that.
Sorry.
So, 1967, she tries to serve him with divorce papers, but then he fled back to Mexico, so the divorce didn't end up getting finalized until, like, 1973.
Oof.
But she continued to use his last name, Puente, for over 20 years afterwards.
Right, right, yeah. Well, when you like something.
Oh, yeah, sure. And when it goes with it. Yeah. So after her divorce, she focused on...
It's easier to write on a form than Johansson.
Yeah. So she's focusing now on managing this boarding houses. And this is when she takes over a 3-story, 16-bedroom care home at 2100 F Street in Sacramento. And
F is for fucked.
Sure. So, she became known in the community as a resource to aid alcoholics, the homeless, and the mentally ill. She even held AA meetings and assisted her tenants to enroll them in Social Security benefits.
And she's a drunk herself.
Probably. Well, she's a child to alcoholics, so it's pretty big, good chance. So to make sure she was seen as just a sweet, kind old lady, she changed her appearance by wearing older, vintage clothing, like chiffon dresses, and large granny glasses, the, like, really big bottle cap-looking ones.
Bottle-bottomed
glasses.
Yeah, Coke bottle.
Yeah.
Bottle cap.
And she lets her hair go gray. She also made herself a respectable member of the Hispanic community by funding charities and scholarships and radio programs. Like, she would always, like, go to these different, host these different events and, like, or go to them and, like, donate a whole bunch of money.
Now, back then, the radio was the size of your house.
Yeah. So she would, like, got a very good reputation for herself as being, like, you know, kind of, like, a do-gooder and, like, a charitable person.
Mm-mm.
And everyone's like, oh, she's so sweet. Like, oh.
I don't like this. She's doing all this bad stuff.
So in 1976, Dorothea marries her fourth husband, Pedro Montalvo. And again, she's got a pattern here. He was a violent alcoholic. Surprise, she had a type.
Don't vote for Pedro in this.
Yeah. This marriage didn't last longer than, like, a few months. So, oof. Yeah. after that whole thing.
She doesn't, she likes a lot of foreign people.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, she likes
those. She's not marrying, you know, Mr. Smith.
I don't know. I think, I don't know, the first guy she married might have been American. I don't know.
Johansson.
No, the McFall guy.
Oh, McFall. No, McFall's Irish. Baby. All
right, well, I don't know.
McFall is straight Irish.
She likes an eclectic mix of people.
What?
So after this marriage doesn't really work out, she starts going to these local bars where she can find, like, older men who are receiving Social Security benefits.
And take their Social Security benefits.
So what she would do is she would meet a man at a bar, you know.
Harder than it looks.
Flirt with him.
Well, that's easy, but the harder part.
Get him to take her back to his place, and then she would drug his drink, and then he would, like, so it would paralyze him, and, well, like, while he was paralyzed, she would steal from him. So he could, like, see everything was going on, but he couldn't do anything because he was, like, paralyzed. Like, kind of like in that episode of You where...
You're spoiling.
Sorry.
Don't spoil it.
No, but somebody gets paralyzed.
There is an episode...
Where somebody gets paralyzed, and I'm not going to say who.
Of the series You, where someone is paralyzed, and someone can see everything someone else is doing.
I'm not going to say who it was. Anyway. So that happens.
All right.
So, yeah, in 1981, she
You know what? I didn't like it in You, and I don't like it here. No.
Yeah, in 1981, she then starts renting the upstairs apartment at 1426 F Street in downtown Sacramento. And this is when she starts, that's when she moves into that building.
Oh, she moved in there. She starts renting the place. Not renting it out. Renting. She starts renting it
and then also renting it. It's kind of unclear as to when, like, she took over the entire building. I think the original owner, like, moved out, and then she kind of, like, took over the lease and... But she was living on the upstairs apartment, and then the downstairs was for, like, her tenants or whatever.
Huh.
Because it's, like, a whole house, really, kind of.
Yeah.
Like, one of those big, like, you know, full house looking, like...
Full house.
Townhousey looking, like...
Everywhere you look.
Kind of like that, yeah.
There's a heart, there's a room.
Yeah, something like
that. That some crazy lady's renting.
Yeah. So,
Whatever.
The murders in the boarding house are assumed to have started sometime after this.
This is like a really dark rendition of Bubby's Boarding House. Mm. You ever seen Bubby's Boarding House?
I haven't seen Bubby's Boarding House.
All our Jewish listeners will know Bubby's Boarding House.
Yeah, well, I guess this is...
It was puppets, and they were Jewish.
Oh.
Jewish puppets. Great. And what happened was... It's all these antics inside of a boarding house.
Well, there's a lot of antics, yeah. But mostly Dorothea was committing them.
But Jewish. Mm-hmm. Mine, Jewish. This one I'm talking about is a Jewish antic.
And I don't know if Dorothea has a religious affiliation. I don't think she does.
She's a kindly Christian woman.
Well, that's what she appears to be, but I don't
or
know.
Or she would know. Have you think.
All right, well, so... Dorothea's boarding house has had mixed reviews, but, you know, it was like...
Five stars on Yelp, and then one star on Yelp.
That's what I was
one star on Yelp, couldn't get out alive. Five stars on
but
Yelp.
But it was the if you would let me finish talking, it was 1980, so it wasn't like these people could look it up on Yelp, because there was no internet.
See? Go ahead, make your job.
So, some tenants complained that she was stingy and wouldn't give them their mail or their money, and others thought she was incredibly kind and generous.
Three stars. We had a good stay, but I could not get my mail.
And then, so she comes up with this whole scheme to start killing her tenants for financial reasons so she could take their money.
Two stars. She tried to kill me, but I got out of there. Two stars. Had a lovely breakfast.
The first person, victim of Dorothea, is in 1982. She makes friends with this woman, Ruth Monroe. Ruth is a retired pharmacist and a wife and a mother. She has a whole family, and her husband is diagnosed with terminal cancer, so he is living in a VA hospital permanently. So Ruth was living all by herself, and she was, like, depressed, didn't want to be living alone. Her kids had all moved out, and she meets Dorothea, and they... come up with this idea that they would start a catering business together. And Ruth is a very sweet and, like, trusting person, so She opens a joint bank account with Dorothea, and then Dorothea offers Ruth to come live in her house, like, as a tenant. And Ruth's like, oh, that's great! But then as soon as she moves in, her health starts to decline. And
Ruth does?
Yeah, Dorothea keeps feeding her these, like, creme de menthe cocktails, and they would make Ruth really groggy and really weak. And at one time, like, she was visiting with her, like, her family, I think probably her children, and she confessed to them that she thought she was going to die, but she didn't know why or how. And then soon after, she dies from an overdose of codeine and Tylenol.
Huh.
So police come and investigate this, and Dorothea told them it was a suicide, that Ruth was depressed because her husband was terminally ill. So, yeah, they eventually just were like, oh, it's a suicide. They didn't really investigate it.
Nobody looked into it?
No.
It's not a suicide.
I know, but it looked like one, so they were just like, alright, some old lady killed herself.
What?
And then a few weeks later, the police returned because 74-year-old Malcolm McKenzie accused Dorothea of drugging and stealing from him. So, like, this was one of the guys she...
There's a Scottish name, if we ever heard one.
Yeah.
Malcolm McKenzie.
She picked him up at a bar.
Scottish last names.
And he was the only one that, like, I guess, like, you know, followed up on and, like, charged her for it. But, like, she was...
That'll be $47.
She was...
That'll be $47.
She was brought to trial, and on August 18th, 1982, Dorothea is convicted and sentenced to 3 charges of theft and sentenced to 5 years in prison.
And she goes to jail for the rest of her life.
For 5 years.
She gets out?
Yeah.
Whilst she's in prison.
She gets herself a pen pal. How sweet. Good old 77-year-old Emerson Gilmouth.
Gilmouth?
I know that's his name. I don't know.
Emerson. See, if I was going to make up a name, I might say Emerson Gilmouth.
Well, he's a retired widow from...
He's a retired widow?
He's a widowed retiree.
Oh, a widowed retiree.
From Oregon. And so he's writing to Dorothea.
Portland.
Oregon. I don't know where in Oregon.
And he's down in Sacramento?
No, he's in Oregon.
Oh, right.
So he's writing to her back and forth. And they're like, you know, or I guess passing their notes, start getting, I guess, a little romantic and...
Uh-oh, raunchy.
That kind
of
thing.
When you get out of there in 4 years, we're going to have a big time.
Yeah, something like that. And so he's like... He even says, like, in his letters, he's like, well, when you get out, I'm going to drive down there, and I'm going to pick you up outside in my red 1984 pickup, and we're going to drive off into the sunset together, or whatever. I added that sunset bit, but, I mean, it seems like something that he would say.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. So when she gets paroled 3 years after her sentence, so she doesn't stay for 5 years, she only stays for 3 years, and in 1985 she's released, and
Emerson... Keep this woman in jail.
Drives to California, meets her outside the prison in his red 1984 pickup, and they drive off together. And
Emerson, but not into the sunset.
No, they drive back to...
Sacramento,
to the boarding house where he moves in with her. And soon they're making wedding plans. Oh, sweet.
No, not sweet.
And then, of course, they open a joint bank account because she loves her joint
bank account. Did she close the other one?
Probably not.
Ruth's banking?
Probably not. Oh, or, I mean, maybe she did, but I think, like, it was probably empty after she died.
Took all the money out.
And everyone was like, I don't know. Yeah. So, they open their joint bank account, and they pay $600 a month in rent for the apartment at 1426 F Street. And around this time, after a while, in 1985... Ismael Flores is hired by Dorothea to install some wood paneling in her apartment. And she pays him $800, and in addition to that, she also gives him a red 1980 Ford pickup that she claims belonged to an ex-boyfriend who, quote-unquote, didn't need it anymore. And the last thing she asks Flores to do is to build her a 6-foot by 3-foot by 2-foot box so she could store her books and other items.
If I didn't know any better, I'd say that's coffin shaped.
Probably. It could be. Makeshift. And so he builds the box for her, and he's like, all right, sure, yeah, we'll put your books or whatever in here.
Oh, yeah, put your books in here. What is this, Emerson? What is this?
So they build the box, and he gives it to her, and then she fills it up, and then she has it nail it shut, and she asks him to help her transport it to a storage depot. Cause she's like, I can't keep this in my house or whatever. It's too much.
It has the books in it? The books.
But it's so heavy she can't, he can't lift it himself.
Why is all the books weigh about 160 pounds?
They need to get a neighbor to like come in and help them lift it into the truck.
Why, she really got rid of these books. They're dead weight. All right, here we go.
And this is like, you know,
but in their defense, books are heavy when you put them in boxes.
I know, but yeah. This is really like, in the point in the documentary, there's like John Cabrera's like, and at this point, Emerson's pickup becomes a hearse.
And at this point, Emerson's pickup becomes a drop off.
So basically, yeah, he's like, they load him into the pickup truck and, they're like, no problem. And so they go and they're on the way to the storage depot. And as they're on the way, she's like, you know what? Just stop. Stop. And so he stops on the side of the road and near the garden highway, on the garden highway in Sutter County. And she's like, just dump the box in the river. I don't really want it.
Dump the box in the river.
And Flores is like, what? You wanted me to build this box?
The books will get wet.
In there
and, you ever have wet books? Terrible.
And all that stuff.
No
worries. And she's like, oh, it's just junk. I don't really want it.
Junk? It's books.
They just dumped it on the side of the riverbank.
No, I care. This is disrespectful to books.
And no one really kind of like, it's not found until January 1986, January 1st on New Year's Day. A fisherman is like just, you know, kind of
working on the river. On New Year's Day?
And spots this strange corpse-shaped box sitting 3 feet from the bank of that same river and calls the police. And when police open the box, there definitely isn't books in it. It's a decomposed, unidentifiable body of an elderly man. So.
I don't like that.
Obviously, this.
Is it Emerson?
We all know that this is Emerson. The cops don't know it's Emerson. He's a John Doe for the next, like, 3 years. And while that happens, Dorothea continues collecting his pension checks and writes letters to his family saying, oh, he can't contact you right now because he's not feeling well.
So tell him to write at a different time.
Yeah, so, like, she's writing all these letters to his family.
She's writing letters saying he can't do something right now, he's not feeling well?
She's, like, saying that the reason he hasn't contacted them is because he's ill.
It's not a time thing.
I know, but I don't know. She's doing that. And then, so, at this point, this is when the owner of 1426 F Street moves out. And so this is when she starts renting out the first floor to sublet for, like, elderly tenants. So that she wasn't actually renting it out before that.
She only kills elderly people?
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah.
It's better than children.
Sure. It's still not great.
It's still not great. I don't like it.
Yeah, so... Yeah. Other than Ruth and Emerson living with her, she was just having those two people live with
Ruth,
her.
Ruth, Waldo, Emerson.
But I guess the owner of the building was living on the bottom floor. And then,
that's Ralph Waldo.
They move out, so Dorothea starts renting that too. And then she sublets it for cheap to elderly, and like kind of gears it towards like elderly tenants. So she accepts about 40 new tenants, mostly drug addicts and alcoholics. But she ran a tight ship, as they say. Boarders paid $350 a month for a room and two hot meals a day, breakfast at 6:30 a.m. and dinner at 3:30 p.m.
Early bird special.
The early bird special, as we call it.
Say breakfast at 6:30 a.m. and dinner at 6:30 p.m.
No, it's 3:30 p.m.
But this is the early bird special, yeah.
So if you miss either one of those, you would go hungry because tenants weren't allowed in the kitchen at odd hours. Whatever that means.
Meaning like 4 or 5?
Yeah, not at like dinner time. Like not 6 o'clock. You can't be in here.
You just can't be rooting around for a banana.
Just like I told you, I eat at 3:30 and then you don't get anything else.
You got your banana at 6:30. Get out of here.
So they weren't allowed to touch the phone or the mail. If they did, Dorothea would rip them a new one. She'd yell at them like...
This mail thing again.
I know. So the tenants weren't even allowed to drink either. But she did keep a fully stocked bar for herself in her apartment. So she soon...
Well, I understand the not sharing part. Shit's expensive. You don't want to start giving it out.
Yeah, well, and I think most of the people that she had living there were also like...
nobody respects it.
They were like alcoholics and drug addicts.
So they just needed it. They didn't really respect it.
No, they just probably, in terms of like their... She was like popular with social workers like Judy Moyes because she agreed to take these tough cases. Oh, right,
the Moyes woman.
And that she agreed to take these tough cases of like alcoholics and drug addicts and people that no one else wanted to take on.
But she killed them. And she gave them
a place to live.
But she killed them.
And the other social worker.
That's like, not what you're supposed to do.
I know that's not what you're supposed to do, but they obviously didn't know that was happening at the time.
Sorry.
Social worker who is also like frequently recommends Dorothea is Peggy Nickerson. And she actually sent 19 people to live in the boarding house between 1987 and 1988. Of course, Dorothea never mentioned any of these social workers that she had 5 felony conviction charges. Or
I know, Dorothea has a lot of felonies.
For drugging and robbing the elderly.
You would think, like, she should be in jail. She'd been in and out of jail. Every time they let her out of jail, she got back in jail.
She is violating her parole by, like,
running
interacting
anything.
With these people.
Talking to a person in general. Well, that is not selling her groceries.
No, I mean, like, she's not supposed to be involved with, like, elderly people, like, she's in any capacity. I guess
elder
like,
law is coming for this woman's ass.
But no one was, like, checking up on this, so, obviously. So, she would get her tenants on Social Security, then she would collect all the mail before they could see it, cash the checks, and only give them a portion of it, and then just pocket the rest. Which brings us back to the beginning with the disappearance of Bert Montoya.
We're back to the beginning?
Yeah.
Is this almost over?
We're at the middle bit.
Middle bit?
I don't know. Well, we have the...
We're gonna break it up.
No, we're not. It's fine. So, yeah. After Detective Cabrera and Officer Rick find this human bone, they're like, whoa, hold up. We gotta call in for backup. And they turn to Dorothea, who's like, how did that get there? That's not mine.
Femur? I hardly know her.
Okay. She's like, well, other people lived here before me. Maybe they put it there.
It's somebody else's femur.
How'd you know it was a femur? I'm a vegetarian.
How'd you know it was a femur?
So, at first they're like, oh,
could have sworn
sure.
I put the head that way.
At first they're like, yeah, it totally could be somebody else. Like, how dangerous could this sweet little old lady be? So they take her down to the station and question her. And when Detective Cabrera is questioning Dorothea, she's, like, totally relaxed. Like, not even breaking a sweat. She denies everything. She says she doesn't know that how that got there, and she has nothing to do with it. And...
I was just holding it for a friend.
Yeah. And she does, like, he does, like, catch her in lies, but he doesn't have enough, like, evidence to hold her, so he has to let her go. But then he...
Catch and release.
But then he says he's gonna return the next day and continue the investigation, so they're gonna return with more officers and...
All right, back tomorrow.
Continue excavating her backyard. So, the next day, the police return with a full forensics crew and the officials from the coroner's office and a county work crew, and they begin digging again. They uncover the rest of the body that they discovered the day before, and they...
Nobody dug it up.
...realize that it's a small female with gray hair, that it actually rotted into the skeleton. And then, after that, they started drilling. There's a slab of concrete that she, like, made, like, a patio out of. They started drilling in there to, like, get through, because they're like, what's under here? So they, like, are just basically tearing apart her old backyard.
And there's something under there?
Just as they were about to get through, Dorothea calls over to the detective, and she's like, Detective, this process is very upsetting for me, and I just need to get out for a little bit. So she asks if she can go have a cup of coffee at the Clarion Hotel that's right down the block.
They say yes?
So yeah, of course they do.
No.
So she puts on this little red coat and
Cabrera
walks her to the hotel and she's watches her go away. In and returns to the property to continue overseeing the digging.
Little Red Riding Hood is running away.
Of course, once they get through the concrete, they find, you guessed it, another body.
Dun dun dun. She's a wolf in grandma's clothing.
Pretty much. And then his sergeant is like,
this is concrete evidence that we have.
He's like, Cabrera, where's the little old lady? He's like, oh, she's just down the street at the hotel having a coffee.
No, she's not.
And then sergeant's like, nah, dude, she's not there. So he rushes back to the hotel and he sees for himself that she's, of course, not there.
She's finished her coffee.
Why would you be?
Well, she's actually, if she finished her coffee, she's probably in the bathroom.
Nope, not in the bathroom either. He talks to the staff at the front desk.
You drink
desk.
Coffee that fast? Oof.
He talks to the Oof. Staff at the front desk, and they said the little old lady in the red coat used the payphone and called the cab company as soon as she stepped inside the lobby. So
didn't even have a coffee?
Nope.
Sounds like they have good coffee, though. Now I want a coffee from the Clarion, I do. All
right, well, it's in Sacramento. I don't even know if it's there anymore, so I can't say.
Mm-hmm.
So the crew at the house is like, they keep digging under the concrete, and they dig up two more bodies.
So in addition Clary
to the one that they
like,
just found, they'd dig up another one on top of that.
Okay, so
and, like,
what's our count up to, four?
It's three.
Three.
So yeah, they dug up one and then they dug up two more the next day. I think. And then at this point, Cabrera's like, shit, I fucked up. This is bad. And of course, the press gets a hold of the story and they're like, oh my God.
And what year is this?
This is 1988.
Oh, so it's kind of recent.
I don't know if that's recent, but okay. But yeah. So,
88?
The press is like, oh my God, I can't believe, like, they're running the story and they're like, I can't believe the police let this woman go. She has, like, bodies in her backyard and all this stuff. And the citizens of Sacramento are outraged and baffled that this little old lady outsmarted their police department.
By calling a cab.
Pretty much, yeah. So by November 14th, remember, like, this started on November 11th. This is by November 14th when the police have finally finished, like, excavating her yard. They have unearthed seven bodies altogether in various areas of the yard. The last body they found had no hands, no head, and no legs.
No, it's missing so much.
That's going to be difficult to ID.
It's missing so much.
And since Detective Cabrera
it's a torso.
Lost the
they
prime,
found a torso.
Pretty much, lost the prime. Oh. Well, she had arms, I think. Lost the prime suspect. Oops. Police have nothing better to do at this point but keep collecting evidence and trying to ID who these bodies are and what Dorothea's motive would be in killing all of them and burying them in her backyard.
Taking that joint bank account.
So this is when they begin searching her house for evidence.
And what do they find?
So after he walks into the kitchen, Detective Cabrera finds this manila envelope with multiple social security cards with different names on them. He also finds bank statements, social security checks, and a driver's license with Dorothea's photo and the name Betty Palmer on it. So unless she has a twin sister, that doesn't add up.
Oh, so her, she was going by the name Betty Palmer?
She had, an ID that said Betty Palmer with her photo on it. So, Detective Cabrera, being the smart guy that he is sometimes, I mean, he's a smart guy, I'm sure, but, like, he just didn't think he needed to keep track of a little old lady. He puts two and two together, and he realizes, oh, this is why she's killing all these people.
Why?
So she can assume their identity and keep cashing the checks that they're getting. So she keeps, like, bringing in the money.
Who is Betty Palmer, right?
Yeah. Who is Betty Palmer?
Right?
That's a good question.
Yeah, like Twin Peaks.
Oh.
Who is Laura Palmer?
Laura Palmer. Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I didn't get the reference.
All right. Sorry.
That you were genuinely asking me. So, he also comes across a book that's called 150 Commonly Prescribed Drugs, A Guide to Their Uses and Side Effects.
The only book she kept, am I right?
Curious, because when he goes into her bedroom, he notices several different prescription
plants.
Medications.
Oh,
One of them was filled to the top of the bottle with these blue pills. And he looks in her bedroom.
Little blue pills? I tell you what those are.
No. They're not Viagra.
Oh, darn.
That wasn't invented yet.
Oh, darn. That's fine.
I think it's, I forget what the drug is called. I think it's called Dalmine.
I thought I was one ahead of the killer.
So, one of them was filled to the top of these blue pills. And then he looks in her bedroom drawers and he finds the empty blue pill capsules. So, like, just the capsules without anything in them.
Uh-huh.
And then he's like, okay, I get what's happening here. She's
take out the stuff.
Taking it out and putting
the
it,
the thing that dissolves in your body, remove that.
She's, putting it in people's drinks or food or whatever. Mm-hmm. And she has been arrested for drugging people before, so she's probably at it again. So she would pull apart the capsules and pour the contents into her tenants' drinks. Or their food, sometimes, possibly. I think it was mostly drinks, but... because they all presumably ate the same food. So she would pull apart the capsules and pour the contents into her tenants' drinks.
Mm-hmm.
Only this time she was looking to kill them, so they couldn't turn her in. So she would get her tenants to co-sign on all their checks over to her so she could go down to this local bar and get them cashed. Apparently that's a thing that bars do in the 80s. There are also banks.
They used to, it was funny. They used to cash checks at bar.
I don't remember doing it like the...
That's very enabling.
Exactly. So, after he checks out her bedroom, he ventures into the middle room off the kitchen. There's like another room off the kitchen. And he finds this day bed in there. And there's like And he finds this day bed, and there's two carpets layered on top of each other next to it. And he pulls up both. He's like, why is there two carpets here? So he pulls both of them up, and he gets hit in the face with this really nasty odor because on the
decaying body.
Yeah, on the floor there was, like, literally,
I don't like this part.
Petrified body fluid.
No.
On the ground.
The stains, not on the nice rug.
And the stains actually, like... underneath the nice rug. The stains actually, like, formed an outline of a person in, like, the fetal positions. So he deduces that this is the death room.
No.
That's what he calls it.
Oh.
So he figures...
Now I'm in the fetal position.
That... this is where she kills them. And she just leaves them lying on the floor until she has an opportunity to bury them in the backyard. And while the body is sitting there, it's just, like, kind of, like, leaking out of all the orifices all over the floor. And apparently, tenants and also neighbors, like, complained about the horrible, foul smell. And she was like, oh, no, it's just the sewer drains. So, she's like, yeah, it's just the sewer drain. And they even had, like, a health department guy come out there and investigate at one point. But
sewer's fine, ma'am.
He never finds anything.
Clean as a whistle.
Yeah, so they're like, what is that,
might
then?
Be your kill... It might be your death room that's smelling so bad.
So
anyway, that'll be $300.
At this point, police are getting into trying to, like, identify the bodies.
Oh, sure, I take checks.
And they thought it was going to be a hard thing to do, because most of them are badly decayed and, like, are not, like, still... are very, like, they're various states of decomposition. So they brought in the feds, and they had this meeting downtown, and they, there's also a Social Security rep who is present, and he suggests that he look up a list of names of the tenants who received Social Security benefits at 1426.
There you go. Now you'll know who they are.
Within, like, the last 5 years.
Right.
So, and because all the bodies were, like, mostly really badly decayed, some of the internal organs had, like, melded together in, like, a big blubbery clump.
No, I'm done. You want to stop for a second?
Nope. Bert Montoya was among them. I don't forget when they, like, kind of ID him, but I forget what number body he is, but he's in there somewhere.
My name is Bert Montoya. You killed me. Prepare to die.
The only two bodies that they were able to fingerprint were fingerprinted, and that's how they discovered the identity of Dorothy Miller, who was 64. She was a 64-year-old American Indian woman.
Dorothy?
Mm-hmm.
Spelled correctly. The right Dorothy.
And She served as a nurse in World War II, so she had fingerprints on file from that.
Uh-huh.
And she had severe PTSD, which caused her to drink in excess. Uh-huh. She was living in Texas with her daughter and her grandchildren until her drinking got so out of control that her daughter was like, I don't think you can live here with my kids.
Even the drinking problems are bigger in Texas.
So they moved her into a VA hospital, and in Thanksgiving of 1987...
Thanksgiving? Oh, see, there we go. There we go. I was wondering how the Thanksgiving was... And an hour in, we paid it off.
It's in the Thanksgiving in 1987, she disappeared, and then, lo and behold, a year later, she winds up in some lady's backyard in California.
Huh.
Her family looked for her and got no leads, and then they get a call being like, oh, your grandma is
we found her.
Buried in this lady's
backyard.
You're
gonna hate this.
So she was found with her arms taped to her chest with duct tape in Dorothea's backyard.
Nope.
The other body they were able to identify by fingerprints was Benjamin Fink.
We think it's him. We don't know. We think it's him.
And Ben Fink was a 55-year-old criminal and an alcoholic.
Ben Fink?
Yeah. So that's why they could identify him by fingerprints.
Because he was what, a criminal?
Yeah. And according to the tenants, he was making a disturbance one day downstairs. So Dorothea comes down and she takes him away and she turns to everyone and she says, I'm gonna go make Ben better.
He'll be dealt with. Oh, yeah. No, I like what she said better.
That's the last everyone saw of him. So bye-bye, Ben.
And then it's bye-bye, Mr. Fink, which is my favorite Broadway musical, by the way.
Mm.
We have to go see it again. Bye-bye, Mr. Fink.
Bye bye, Mr. Fink.
Uh-huh.
I thought it was Bye Bye Birdie. Anyway, on November 17th. Damn it! Don't make fun of me. I have a speech impediment. Dorothea has been on the run for about 3 days at this point.
She's been on the run for 3 days.
You know, or maybe not 3 days. I don't know. Maybe it's 5 days, I guess.
Anytime I hear the words 3 days, I think of Family Matters when they're in Disney World.
I guess
World.
He ran away on the... It's very difficult to say that she ran away either on the 12th or... Maybe so then it might have been...
5 days.
5 days, yeah. So I wrote three, but I think it was five.
Could have been 5 days.
So Detective Paul Luzon... at the LAPD gets a visit from this man claiming...
Paul
Luzon.
Oh, Paul... my name is Paul Luzon.
And so he gets a visit from this man. He comes in. He's like, I think I know where this Dorothea Puente lady,
really?
This murder boarding house lady is.
Really?
And what happened is Dorothea hopped into a cab. She headed to La La Land.
The movie?
No, just...
Spotlight.
Los Angeles.
Oh.
And then she goes to a bar and she picks up this guy, Charles Wilgus.
Me? Oh, my first name. Charles.
And she introduces herself as Donna Johansson and starts to ask him a bunch of personal
Charles
questions.
Charles Wilgus?
Yeah. About what he does for a living and how much money he gets in Social Security. She even offers to move in with him and fix him Thanksgiving dinner.
Those are her first three questions. Oh, hi, what's your name? What do you do for a living? How much Social Security do you get?
I mean, I was like...
Mother's maiden name? Date of birth?
A little bit soon, maybe.
Can I make you Thanksgiving? Can I fix your life and make Thanksgiving?
And Charles is like, oh, yeah, sure. And, like, so he gets her information.
You like turkey with the insides of little blue pills?
They go out and get a chicken sandwich together, and he takes her information down, and she tells him that, like, the cabbie that dropped her off, like, left with her suitcase, so they agree that they're going to go shopping together tomorrow. And
the old cabbie's got my suitcase, Virginia.
So he... drops her off at her motel, which is like the Royal Viking Motel. And then he thinks about it and he's like, I feel like I've seen this woman before. And then he realizes
on the news
this is where I've seen this woman before. She's on the news
everywhere. Right, for killing people.
Right. So then he goes to the cops and he tells them that she's staying at the Royal Viking Motel in room 31.
And you better find this cabbie because I don't think he's going to fare too well. He has her suitcase and...
Well, she didn't have a suitcase. That's the whole point.
Oh, I'm sorry. I misunderstood. She's a liar. You're a liar.
So they all go down there. They like surround the motel. Detective Luzon knocks on the door. This older woman answers, and he says,
"Detective Luzon."
He asks if it's Dorothea. She's like, "All right." He's like, "Are you Dorothea Puente?" And she says, "Yes."
Are you Dorothea Puente?
So L.A. could only like hold her for a short period of time before bringing her up on charges. So the Sacramento police had to borrow like a private jet.
They fly her private?
Well, the news channel, no. KCRA.
KCRA from, where is it?
Sacramento.
Sacramento, California. We're coming at you live from KCRA.
They lend the police their jet, so.
Let's see what happened. Well, we gave our private jet to the LAPD. Here we go.
It's the San Francisco, or Sacramento PD.
We gave our to the LAPD. They gave it to the Sacramento PD. Funny mix-up. Everybody.
So she wouldn't, like, slip through the cracks and be like, I'm gonna go now, bye.
We flew a criminal private over there.
Okay, so Detective Cabrera comes himself and he picks her up. And Dorothea doesn't say anything to him at first, but then she finally says...
He goes, I know you from somewhere. Don't I know you from...
He says, Detective, I'm sorry.
Sorry for how we ended things before. I didn't like their coffee.
So, yay! They got her back in custody.
Oh, they have her? Good.
Yes. And this time, they don't waste any time at all charging her with the murder of Burton Montoya.
Thank you so much.
But they still have 4 unidentified bodies with no cause of death. So
it's the little poisonings.
Back to the drawing board there.
It's the blue pill poisoning.
So from the Social Security dude, they get this list of possibilities, and they narrow it down to 13 people who had gotten...
13 people, why?
13 people who had gotten Social Security there in the last, like, you know, 5 years or whatever.
Right.
Since they couldn't rely on dental records, I guess, because, you know, old people don't have teeth.
They have dentures.
Yeah.
Do we have denture records? Huh?
No. We went on to the next best thing.
The guy who makes them.
No, x-rays.
X-rays, right.
That's how they actually wound up identifying most of them. So the last body they found, the one with no head. was the first one they identified in this group. Because they realized that the victim had hip replacement surgery. And this is what allowed them to identify Betty Palmer, 78.
Who is Betty Palmer?
This is Betty Palmer.
This is Betty Palmer.
She was the only one body that seemed to have been dismembered before burial, I guess, for whatever reason.
Maybe who killed Betty Palmer, isn't that it?
I mean, it's never really explained how she gets these bodies, like, into the ground. It's assumed that she had help from, one of her other tenants. I think it's John Crawley or something, and he does get arrested at one point, but then, like, the charges get dropped because they don't really have evidence that he, like, helped her out or anything. Suspected that she had help, like, burying all these bodies.
Right, because it's hard, you know, it's hard to do, right?
And she's also, like, a 5-foot...
As a guy who's never done it, it's hard.
She's like a 5-foot-1, like, woman. She's very short.
It's hard to do, right?
She's very frail and short. So the next body they identify is that of James Gallup, 62. Mm-hmm. And it's because he had undergone brain surgery. So he had been operated on his skull. So he was a pretty tough cookie, though. He survived a heart attack and a brain tumor. Just not Dorothea.
Oh.
Yeah, I know. It's rough.
Oh.
The other two victims they ID'd by x-ray were Vera Faye Martin, who was 64, and Leona Carpenter, who was 78. Leona Carpenter was the body that they first found that Detective Cabrera thought was a tree root. And when they were...
Her name's Carpenter. It's a miscommunication on that she wasn't actually wood.
Huh. Well, you're going to love this part. You know when I said that they were, like, picking up pieces of what they thought was cloth?
Yeah.
That was her skin.
You're hurting me with this, though.
I know. That was pretty disturbing.
You're hurting me.
So,
you like this stuff?
I don't like it, but I've
seen you like this stuff. All right.
I don't like it. I don't
we
like
have that differences.
People are dead, Yana. And I'm like, I just wonder what causes Aleni to do this stuff.
We have such differences, don't we?
So Vera's body was the sixth one they found, and the police, when they dug up the body, found this compacted, like, dirt bridge where her legs were, like, under above her legs. And Detective Cabrera is like, well, how did that get there? And the anthropologist says to him that she might have possibly been buried alive, because she was, like, when you're, like, she might have been, like, trying to kick up, like, the dirt, and that's why it's all compacted like that.
Oh.
Either that or the body atrophied, so it could have been either one of those. But her wristwatch was also still ticking when they found her, like, when they brought her up, the wristwatch she was wearing still worked.
So it was recent.
Not so much. I wasn't so recent that, like, she was, because she was still decomposed badly enough they couldn't get fingerprints. So at this point they're like, okay, this lady has to have more victims than this, or they have an inkling to suspect that there was more than this, because they didn't have enough evidence with the bodies that they did have. Because they all had traces of drugs in their system, but not, like, enough to be like, oh, this is what killed them. So they don't have enough evidence to really, like, kind of nail her. So they do a search in the area for, like, John Doe's or Jane Doe's that were wrapped in, like, Dorothea's style of wrapping, which is, like, she wrapped them in, like, plastic and then, like, a sheet and then, like, taped them.
Yeah.
And that's when they find Emerson Gilmouth, Dorothea's pen pal. She put in a box and dumped in a river. So they still don't really have, like, that's also when they find out about Ruth, about how she moved in with Dorothea and died of what was supposedly a drug overdose. And then they overturn it to murder. They, like, change it to a murder
trial. Overruled. Murder.
At that point.
Can that be the title? Overruled. Murder.
But I already wrote the
only murders fine. In the boarding house. We'll go with overruled murders in the boarding house.
Detective, so they still don't really have that much concrete evidence, surprisingly.
They have a ton of concrete.
All these people were buried in their backyard.
Sammy thinks they have a ton of concrete.
Sammy says they have lots of concrete evidence.
They just dug it up.
Yeah. Well, Sam Foote.
They dug up the concrete. They have a ton of concrete.
Yeah, but they still don't have, like, any, like, hard hitting, like, this is her.
Concrete's hard.
Here's a picture of her drugging people and burying them in the backyard.
There's no video of it. It's
1980s. So her pretrial hearings don't actually even start until April 25th, 1990. And Judge Gail H. Ohansian.
What are you trying to say? What do you call me?
Ohansian.
Ohanesian.
Ohanesian presided over the case, and the prosecution.
Hold on. Judge John H. What is it?
Judge Gail
H. Ohanesian presided.
And the prosecution presents their evidence that Dorothea was a manipulative, greedy, cold-blooded killer whose sole purpose was stealing money from her tenants.
That's actually a good, summation.
So according to investigators, her victims were heavily drugged until they died of an overdose, and then she would wrap them in bed sheets and plastic lining and then drag them into the backyard and bury them. Of course, her court-appointed defense attorneys, Peter Blauton, and Kevin Climo, theorized that Dorothea was a victim of circumstance and implied that these people just happened to die while living with her.
Other pen name is Kevin Climo, I think.
Well, they were like, oh, these people happened to die, and they were living in her residence, so she was afraid that she was going to be held responsible, so she buried them in the backyard and never told anyone.
Told no one, yeah. Reasonable.
Not
without
really.
A reasonable doubt, she buried them in the backyard out of fear. Go on.
So, This goes on for a while, and finally on June 19th, 1990, the judge announced that Dorothea should and would stand trial on 9 counts of murder. Sorry, drink of water. Gotta stay hydrated.
9 counts of murder.
And that was the murder of her boyfriend, Everson Gilmoth, and her tenants, Ruth Monroe, 61, Leona Carpenter, 78, Alvaro Bert / Alberto Gonzalez Montoya, 51, Dorothy Miller, 64, Benjamin Fink, 55, James Gallup, 62, Vera Faye Martin, 64, and Betty Palmer, 78. So, due to numerous delays, I don't know exactly what all the delays were, but the actual trial doesn't take place until February 9th, 1993.
Oh.
And Judge Michael J. Berger.
Judge Michael J. Berger presiding. Now, Virga is little raindrops that actually don't make their way all the way down to the ground. So,
did you just make that up?
Nope. Did okay. not make that up.
So, the trial dragged on as the prosecution and defense presented their cases. And then finally, on July 15th, 1993, after the jury heard 153 witnesses present 3,500 pages of evidence, they retired to deliberate.
The jury did.
Mm-hmm.
On July 15th, the jury heard 153...
By that time, they had heard all that stuff.
153 witnesses?
Because, like, the trial started on February 9th and didn't end until July 15th.
Oof. Talk about jury duty. Long jury duty.
Yeah, so that was, like, months at a time. And they deliberated for, like, weeks.
Yeah.
And they didn't come out until, like, the afternoon of August 2nd.
Right before your birthday.
And they passed a note to the judge announcing that they were deadlocked on all 9 counts and they needed further instructions. And apparently, like, one person, like, didn't
want to convict
her. It was, like, everyone else was like, yeah, she's guilty, but this one person was like, no.
Have you reached a decision? Not a unanimous one.
So then the next day, the judge is like, well, go back and try again. So they do, and finally on August 26th, they emerge again, and they announce that Dorothea Puente is guilty of murder in the second degree of Leona Carpenter, guilty of murder in the first degree of Dorothy Miller, and guilty of murder in the first degree of Ben Fink.
They got her.
On 3 counts, yes. Everyone else.
With Judge Virga presiding.
And so Judge Virga orders a mistrial on the other 6 murder charges.
Why? She did it.
I know, but they don't have enough evidence to prove that.
The only way
they could get a conviction was, like, I think the one juror that was like, I don't think there's enough evidence or whatever, was only, like, willing to, like, meet halfway on that.
And, who,
like,
was the juror? Dorothea?
No. I don't think you can be a juror in your own murder trial.
Nowadays, so, anything is possible.
On December 11th, 1993... the judge sentences Dorothea to life in prison without the possibility of parole.
Nice. We got her.
And she was incarcerated at the Central California Women's Facility in Chowchilla, California.
Chowchilla.
So the rest of her life, as long as she lived, she insists that she didn't do any of this and that everyone died of natural causes.
Yeah, her natural
and that she,
causes.
She admits to stealing from them, but she's like, I didn't kill them. In 1998, Dorothea starts corresponding with Shane Bugby, who is an artist, publisher, multimedia communicator, filmmaker, and event promoter.
Bugby.
According to Wikipedia, anyway. And this resulted in a cookbook called Cooking with a Serial Killer, and it was published in 2004. The cookbook includes a lengthy interview.
No, almost, you're ruining cookbooks.
Almost 50 recipes.
Don't ruin cookbooks.
Almost 50 recipes. What does that mean, though? Almost 50 recipes. Like, one of them's not finished?
At 49 and a half.
And
maybe it's like 47 recipes. And they're like, there's almost 50 recipes in
and then various pieces.
One's an appetizer.
Of quote-unquote prison art that Dorothea sent during their comic correspondence.
No.
So, Dorothea Puente died in prison on March 27th, 2011.
Good.
2011.
Way too late.
From you guessed it. Natural
poisoning
causes.
Poisoning by little blue pills.
No, but real not natural causes. Not her definition of natural causes.
No.
She was 82. The house at 1426 F Street, Sacramento is still there and was included in the 2013 home tour of the Sacramento Old City Association.
It should be counted in the ghost tour of Sacramento.
It was also the subject of the 2015 short, The House is Innocent. That's what all the houses say.
No, not all the house always wins, we know.
And in 2015, the crew from Ghost Adventures did an episode there because people have reported that the house is haunted by Fuente and her former tenants.
Probably. Mm-hmm. I'd believe it.
April 2020, the house and its current owners were featured in a Quibi series, Murder House Flip.
And just like everybody else, never to be seen again because they were on Quibi.
And in June 2020, they were also featured in a 10-minute documentary for 60 Second Docs.
A 10-minute documentary for 60 Second Docs.
Yeah.
I don't get it. 60 seconds is a minute.
And if you want to watch the documentary,
it's
called Murders at the Boarding House. It's on Oxygen. If you get their app or whatever, you can.
And I don't.
It's pretty good.
I don't get their app. I don't want to watch this.
Detective Cabrera answers a lot.
Just like the bodies. It's two parts.
And he's still alive and kicking.
Cabrera?
Mm-hmm.
Good.
They're tired now, obviously.
Oh, yeah, well, you would retire after this case, too. Jesus
Christ. And then the rest of the information I got from, like, Wikipedia and Wikipedia and that sort of thing.
I'm never going to a boarding house. Tell you that much.
Well, yeah, just don't go to a boarding house in Sacramento. Owned by an old
lady. Learned my lesson.
And that's all she wrote there.
That's murder she wrote. Where do you find this stuff?
I don't know. I was looking for something that was like...
gross.
An older woman that killed people.
Ah, for some representation.
Diversity. You know, because I was like... And usually, that is true, the most female...
We've already done the older woman. We did the soap maker of Corazio.
I know, but I was like Thanksgiving, so I thought grandmas, and then...
Oh, you did one. You did do a Thanksgiving-themed one. Dorothea did say she'd make her own a whole Thanksgiving.
For Charles Wilgus.
Burr Wilgus.
Yeah. Apparently she was a very good cook. That was like...
So that's the cookbook. 47, almost 50 recipes of a cookbook.
Yeah, apparently she was a good cook. So she did have that going for her. But...
You know what? Get me the cookbook for Christmas.
I think she's in like several... I found that there's like... serial killer coloring books on Amazon, and she's on like the cover of one of them or something,
holding a box of books.
I don't know, a bottle of pills, probably.
Bottle of pills, yeah. A bottle of red, bottle of white, bottle of blue pills.
Exactly.
That was Billy Joel's other song, Scenes from a Boarding House. It didn't really take off.
Yeah,
I don't think it took off.
I like River of Dreams better.
Oh, right. Yeah, River of Dreams, where they found that guy.
Oh, yeah.
Go walking in the box that's in the river. Go walking in the box that's in the river.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
That's exactly how it goes.
Well, you asked. Anyway, happy Thanksgiving. We're looking forward to doing a Christmas one next year where Santa comes. And
not next year, next month.
Oh, sorry, next month.
We haven't quite gotten to the two.
Well, I might be right. We're looking forward to doing one next year.
No, but I'm trying to get them at least monthly, but it's sorry. The holidays stress me out. It's crazy.
The holidays stress us out. Yeah, monthly. So we're doing monthly.
We're going to get it bi-weekly probably in January.
We will. Are we? We will.
Well, I'll have more time on my hands.
Let's do it. Yeah.
I won't be really working, so I'll just be like, I'm just sitting around looking up serial killer
and
stories.
Do it. I want to get this thing going. Send this podcast to everybody you know who likes serial killers.
True crime. Comedy.
Old women.
Witty banter.
Boxes of wood.
Thanksgiving.
Books.
Serial killer books.
Sacramento.
Boarding houses.
And social security cards.
Exactly. And please like and subscribe on iTunes. Well, I guess it's not iTunes anymore. It's Apple Podcasts.
Apple Podcasts.
Sorry, I'm from...
And we're working on getting it on every other podcast platform.
Yeah, we're also on Spotify and Anchor.
Anchor, of course.
Of course. It's the easiest way to make a podcast.
Yeah, but you heard that in the beginning.
You did. So, yeah, please like and subscribe and rate and review and tell your friends because it's fun.
Yeah, and just say to them, listen, the dog noises don't overpower the show. You'll get used to it.
Apologies for the dog noises. You'll get used to it. I think it's cute. Like, in My Favorite Murder, when they, like, do a little... Well, Elvis is no longer with us, unfortunately. But, when they ask him if he wants a cookie, they used to do it. When they asked him if he wants a cookie, he would go, meow. My dogs aren't really as well trained as that, though.
Yeah, no.
So... Something to work up to.
Right. Okay, well, I am thoroughly disgusted and exhausted from all this turkey talk.
So that means it's bedtime. Say goodnight, Charlie.
Goodnight, Charlie.